We're about to have a conversation with Dr. Stephen Salata, activist and independent academic, author of many books. His latest is called Israel's Dead Soul, and the Reverend Dr. Heber Brown, who's a pastor at Pleasant Hope Baptist Church, community activist, and executive director of Orisha's Cross Freedom School. Good to have you both with us here on the show today. And let me begin. We're going to talk about the juncture here in some ways. People are talking about between the Palestinian struggle, what happened in Gaza, and Ferguson. There have been many links made. But this is also a very complex subject because there's a long history of the black church and the Old Testament and its feeling of unity around the biblical story of slavery in the Jewish holy books and the struggle for freedom in black America. Jews who were in the civil rights movement, the connections there between people's hearts, Jewish liberation and black liberation in the 50s and 60s, and then the eruption of the Palestinian struggle for freedom and the complexities of all this. So we're going to touch on a bunch of that today, and partially because Heber Brown and Stephen Salata will be speaking at CCBC Essex at 12:30 on Friday. The panel is called From Palestine to Ferguson, What Are the Connections? And is sponsored by CCBC's Institute for Social and Economic Justice, the Black Student Union, Department of World Languages, and the Community Book Connection and CCBC's Global Education. And then at 4:30, Stephen Salata will be over at the Homewood campus at Johns Hopkins University as part of their day-long teaching on Gaza on a panel called Boycott as Resistance and Academic Freedom. So let me begin. I mean, Heber, you went to Israel-Palestine.
I did.
On this journey. What was the group you went with?
Interfaith Peace Builders.
And what was that?
So it's an organization that has taken upwards of 40-plus delegations to Israel-Palestine now to meet directly with Palestinians and Israelis who are working for social justice, but also, you know, meet with those who are trying to uphold Zionist political structures as well. So it's a really opportunity to hear directly from people on the ground as opposed to getting the filtered perspectives through American media.
So before we turn to Stephen, I'm just curious just to set this up, and people get to, I mean, people do know you from being on our program a lot and know you from your community activism as well and your church work. But when you went to Palestine, Israel, and when you returned, was there something different about Heber Brown's perspective?
I think I went because I had a hunch that I was not getting the whole story. It was too simplistic a narrative coming across the television. So I had a healthy suspicion about what was actually being reported. And so I went to go and get the facts for myself. And so coming back, many of my suspicions proved to work out right, that things were more complex than what has been presented on the television, and things were not as, you know, just one side of the fair about, you know, Israel defending itself against terrorism, which is always the line and trope that's put across American media. I got a greater view and better perspective on what was going on there, but also there were some surprises as well. I mean, I connected with Africa-descended people in the old city and connected. I mean, I never would have imagined that I would have met folks who looked like me.
From Palestinians or Jews or both?
Both. Mm-hmm. Both. Never would have suspected that. I mean, when I think about it now, it's like, well, duh, of course. I mean, we're all over the world. But that's not the image that's put across American television screens about it. So there were some surprises as well, but I came back way more informed, having heard directly from people on many different sides of this issue.
So, Stephen Salata, I'm really happy you could join us. So you've been to Ferguson, correct?
I have not.
I thought you had. Okay. So I take that back. You haven't been to Ferguson. That's fine. But I'll ask this Ferguson question anyway. One of the things that we've noticed in our intense coverage of Ferguson is there has been a participation by Arab and Palestinian students and the beginnings of a connection between these struggles. I want you to kind of start us off on that conversation.
Yeah, sure. And there's been actually a pretty strong, you could even say a very strong showing of support for the people of and in Ferguson from Palestinians in both the West Bank and Gaza Strip. And I think that speaking from the Palestinian side of things, I think especially young Palestinians, those who are engaged in the struggle of the Israel-Palestine conflict, there's a deep sense of empathy and solidarity with the struggle of various ethnic minorities here in the United States. I think that this generation of young, Palestine activists is doing a much better job, although there's a lot of work yet to be done, intellectually and otherwise. So with sort of taking the Palestine or the Palestinian struggle for liberation and sort of examining it in broader worldly contexts, including the contexts of racism and police brutality here in the U.S.
And Heber, and you participated here in demonstrations around Gaza, right?
Right. I did. I have many different demonstrations around Gaza. And I did because after my trip, I just got clarity on just a huge imbalance as it relates to social justice on the issue, and just the silence of, in particular, the silence of the church, the silence in too
the
many.
The church in general, not just the black church, you mean the church in general?
The church in general, the church in general, indeed. And then with greater specificity as well, the black church, and wanted to make sure that, my voice was a part of those who were calling for justice and helping to move the ball forward for Palestinian sisters and brothers.
So let me kind of talk about the history of this. This is a very powerful moment, I think, because I think this is the first time. Let me take a step backwards here. When I saw some of these demonstrations taking place that were against the Israeli invasion of Gaza and talking about the rights of Gazans and Palestinians and showing solidarity with that, one of the things that was glaring in these demonstrations that I had actually never seen before in all my years of activism were the numbers of black people in those demonstrations.
Hmm.
That's something that's just a new phenomenon, as is, I think, some of the phenomenon of seeing Palestinians and Arab Americans in Ferguson and other struggles around issues of police brutality and violence in this country. So as soon as I saw that, I said, something's afoot. Something is a shift taking place. I'll come back to my shift thing in a moment, but talk a bit about what this shift is. And I don't think I'm crazy. I think I'm seeing something new that I've not seen very much before. Stephen?
Oh, okay. I'll make it as quick as possible, because I'd certainly like to hear the reverend's
absolutely
on this. I would say that there are a lot of things going on. One is that there's in the intellectual and activist tradition of black internationalism, there's always been strong support for the Palestinians. I think that it's been part of the tradition of black activists and intellectual thought for quite some time. Now, of course, a lot of African American activists and intellectuals have disagreed vehemently on the Israel-Palestine conflict. But if you take figures like Stokely Carmichael and Malcolm X, who spent a lot of time in the Arab world, just before his death, and met with the PLO, in fact, when it was a nascent organization. He had a strong relationship with Nasser of Egypt as well, an Arab nationalist. And then the Black Panthers, et cetera. So you can sort of go back through the years, and there's been an engagement with Palestine, in the African American community, and then from the point of view of a type of anti-colonial third world internationalism, you could call it. But I think the more important thing from my point of view is the fact that Arab Americans are starting to get involved in the African American solidarity struggles, and that's something that's needed to happen for a long time. There's finally been a willingness, and it's needed to happen for a long time, to confront anti-black racism in the Arab American community, to confront the exploitation of minority communities by Arab business owners in inner cities and black and Latino neighborhoods. I'm very, very happy that these sorts of conversations are beginning to happen. And I think, again, I don't want to romanticize too much the younger generation, but from what I'm seeing from young people in my own community, the Arab American community, the Palestinian American community, is at least a seriousness about sort of unpacking where we are, right, where we stand in the spaces of American racial dynamics, right, and trying to be supportive of those who are, who are trying to create a better scene here in the United States for people who are still brutalized by segregation, by police violence, and these sorts of things.
Heber.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly have been seeing the shift as well. And I remember when I was a regular blogger, when I was still writing for my site, Faith in Action, I would start writing on this issue on my blog, and my audience was largely African Americans. I remember just the resistance and deep questioning that I would receive when I would first start writing. This may have been a decade ago when I first started writing about these issues. And then when I would attend Palestinian solidarity events and or conferences such as the Sabil conference some years ago. I went in D.C. to a conference, and I was I'm one of, I think, three African-Americans at the conference.
At the Sabil conference.
At the Sabil conference.
Let me step backwards.
Yeah.
The Sabil conference, listeners, the family, is a conference of Christian-Palestinian radical organization opposing Zionism and fighting for Palestinian liberation, but specifically from a Christian Palestinian perspective. That's who Sabil is.
Exactly.
I don't let people know who that was.
Yeah. So I was one of the very small handful of people at the conference, maybe some handful of years ago, somewhere between 8 and 9 years ago. But recently, I definitely am seeing that shift and that change in terms of people taking the time. Palestinians and American Africans taking the time to really do some studying of not only our own place and our own context, but also the ways in which there are overlaps. I think it is important to say here as well that we should also be careful not to conflate and make the Palestinian struggle for liberation and self-determination and the historic black freedom struggle conflated into the same thing. I don't think the goal is to say this is that. Like, and that equivalence, I think, is problematic because there are definitely nuances and distinctions that need to be observed and respected, even as there are overlaps where, of lessons that we can learn from one another. But the professor is absolutely right. Historically, there has been voices in the black community. Huey P. Newton's essay on the Middle East, people can Google that and read his thoughts from the 60s where, he says, quote, "We support the Palestinians' just struggle for liberation 100%. And we will go on doing this. And we would like for all of the progressive people of the world to join our ranks in order to make a world in which all people can live." And so, I mean, historically, there's been those messages. And then also, there have been, Malcolm X and so many others saying we need to go to the United Nations. And so, of course, those voices have special resonance now. For example, Malcolm X is talking about going to the United Nations because the mother of Trayvon Martin, Sabrina Fulton, and the father of Jordan Davis, Ron Davis, were recently in Geneva testifying about police brutality before the UN. And so there are definitely connections. There are definitely things to be, looked at. There's definitely some self-reflection, some study, and even some some supporting going on across communities. And it has taken time, but probably it needs to take time. Because I think whenever it becomes so forced, Mark, that it's like, let's just get together and sing Kumbaya and fight. I think that can be problematic, and people can begin to feel like they are pawns or their story is being commodified for another community without any real honoring of their own struggle.
So let me kind of explore this a bit further even in more of its depth, because I do believe this is a significant moment. And on many levels in history, between blacks and Palestinians, African-Americans and Palestinians, between elements of the Jewish community and the Israeli community and Palestinians and African Americans. There's a lot of complexity here, and I'm going to just throw it out at you for a minute and see what we think. One of the things that struck me, what you just said, Stephen, was something that I remember hearing from Jewish radicals and revolutionaries in the 60s and still later on, which was, you said about the Arab American community, which was Jews saying, we have to deal with racism inside of the Jewish world, and we have to deal with our own sense of exploitation, or the reality of exploitation by certain parts of the Jewish community in businesses in the black community. And you just said the same thing about Arab Americans, which I found a really kind of interesting kind of a historical touch there. You mind kind of playing with that for a minute?
I'll try. I think the parallels that you mentioned, I think, are very, very appropriate, right? Given especially the strong historical ties between Arabs and Jews, right, inside and outside of the United States, and those ties haven't always been happy ones, but they're ties nonetheless. These are two communities that you don't just separate from one another, because you can't separate from one another, right? I feel like, as a largely voluntary immigrant community, that Arab Americans have an obligation intellectually and morally to understand our place in various racial hierarchies that we entered into when we came into the United States. I guess you could say that, take my family, for instance. Both of my parents are immigrants. My mom from Nicaragua, my dad from Jordan, and they settled in southern Appalachia, an extremely racist place where I was growing up. You know, and there were very few immigrant families there, but there were a lot of black folks because it was coal mining country, you know, and so they had migrated there for work along with white ethnics such as Italians, Poles, etc. But we dealt with a tremendous amount of xenophobia in our all-white neighborhood, a tremendous amount, and it could be extremely painful, but at the same time, we had an opportunity to move into a neighborhood as immigrants that African Americans wouldn't have had the opportunity to move into, right? So we were more privileged than certain polities already as part of the United States. And I'm happy to say that my parents, were anti-racist, you know, and they taught me not to participate in these kinds of hierarchies. But the point is, we're still part of a settler community vis-a-vis indigenous peoples, and we're still part of a community that has benefited economically, whether we asked to or not, from the structures of racism that we encountered when we came into the United States in the first place. And I think we need to be aware of that. We need to unpack that. And we also need, I think, to confront the elements of racism that exist in the Arab community and preferably expunge them, although I know that's not a simple process. Confronting them, I guess, is the first step before we're in a position to offer useful solidarity to our black brothers and sisters, right? You know, we can't offer solidarity. We can't offer support the way that they need it if the elements of racial privilege to which we're subject as an immigrant community aren't confronted and unpacked in the first place. I don't know if that makes any sense. But
no, it does.
That's my feeling on things.
I think that this is the reason I'm exploring that, because the next question to lead us back to the present day and where we are is that there was a period in American history, Heber Brown, let me start here with you, that where the black liberation struggle and the Jewish liberation struggle were very much tied together,
right?
Especially from the 30s through the 60s,
mm-hmm.
Where the Jews and leftists among the Jewish community were the few groups that kind of were in solidarity with black liberation in this country, part of the Communist Party, other places, from the 30s through the 50s. The 85% of the civil rights workers who were white in the South were Jewish. You know, that there was this, and there was this movement that really touched, and Zionism at that point was thought of as a liberation movement along with black liberation, even though it wasn't seen that way by the Palestinian liberation movement at all. So that was there. And then, you know, you had both the Students for Democratic Society and the Students Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, the two most radical groups of whites and blacks in the 60s, organizing where they had these huge debates over Palestine and Israel inside the organizations, really giant rifts that took place. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's, to me, could you speak to where we are from that historical context?
Yeah, I just think that it is a nod to how dynamic human history and our stories are. I mean, it's, you know, we like to, and perhaps we're led to in some ways, to make caricatures of not only individuals, but also to look at the past as static moments in time.
Which they're not.
Right. Which they're right. Definitely not. Right. Right? But right. We're fed this meta-narrative through school, through media and other channels that says, well, this is exactly how it happened. So I struggled, for example, this week talking to my oldest son, who's six, about Rosa Parks. Right. And so I'm struggling because it's Ancestor Day at the school and they're going to talk about different ancestors. And I did not want to tell him Rosa Parks sat down on the bus. I mean, that simplistic narrative,
right.
You know, that's not the fullness of the story. Right. And so I struggled. I turned to YouTube and everything else, try to get ideas on how to introduce my son to this dynamic woman. And all that she did in concert and cooperation with so many others. And so I think when you talk about the Jewish community and the black community between the 30s and the 60s, it was just as I would imagine, just as dynamic then as it is now, because there are
right.
many black religious leaders in particular who will get to the microphone and say, we pray for the peace of Jerusalem. We stand on the side of Israel. The Bible says, right? And so in those moments, I feel a special obligation to stand up and challenge my sisters and brothers. In fact, there was a debate that never happened. But one of the African-American outreach, he was the African-American outreach director for Christians United for Israel.
Okay.
Kufi. This is Pastor John Hagee's book. This is the largest
right.
Christian Zionist
right.
group in the country. And so they hired a pastor out of North Carolina to be their African-American outreach director. And so I read an article that he wrote, and I started seeing his name in different places. And I reached out to him, and I said, man, I just disagree with you, and this is why. And I think you're being used as a pawn in this larger story of trying to further the aims of a Zionism that is positioned itself for the extermination and the permanent taking of land of Palestinian people. And so we went back and forth on Facebook for a while until the point where it's like he said, you know, I'll come to your church and we can debate in front of an audience and let the audience decide. And I said, bring it on. Let's do it. The debate never happened. But the debate in terms of the in black theological circles around how we bring to bear the lenses of our faith to this issue yet remains. And so I'm not sure if we're that much different, Mark, from the 30s and the 60s. Those conversations are still happening. And as the professor said, in the Palestinian and Arab communities, racism and kind of coming to grips with settler identities and settler colonialism and how that intersects with black communities. Those conversations are still happening. And in black communities, you have people rising up as well, engaged in very passionate debates about this issue.
So in the context of what you both were saying, earlier in the conversation, it was said that there was overlap but distinction between the black struggle and African-American struggle in America and the Palestinian struggle. But it was both distinction and overlap. But something clearly is happening. I mean, in the past, we did have leaders like Malcolm X and Kwame Ture who made their positions very clear. But something's happening different now because this is a bubbling up from the bottom that's happening, which you, in our conversation we've had with young people in Ferguson who went to Ferguson, is a dynamic happening here that's connected but not connected to their elders in some ways. So what is this dynamic now? What does it mean for now in the future that you're seeing the chance for Palestinians taking place in Ferguson and vice versa and the other kind of hip-hop groups going in and out of Palestine at the moment? So there's something bubbling. So what is the significance of it? And where do you think it leads? Stephen, let me start with you.
Yes, sir. Two things come to mind for me, mainly. There are other things at play. One, I think the major connection, and I agree completely with the Reverend, that there are tons of nuances and differences to keep in mind. But I think the strongest empirical connection, you could call it, is the deep cooperation between the American and an Israeli government, in terms of the sharing of weaponry, the sharing of expertise, the sharing of resources for police departments, the fact that a lot of members of police departments, including those in St. Louis, were trained in Israel or by people affiliated with Israel, and the way that the U.S. and Israel have in many ways streamlined their policing tactics, right? So I think that's a strong connection to be made right there. And Israel has acted as a proxy of the U.S. in this fashion in different ways, you know, throughout the past 30 or 40 years. And I think the second thing that comes to mind for me is it's real and it has material consequences, but I'm thinking of the symbolism of Israel now. And in so many ways, I believe that Israel has become synonymous in a lot of people's minds with forms of U.S. oppression and suppression, and in many ways as an extension of a distinct form of American racism, right? And as a country that sort of carries the water of the U.S. in some of the uglier elements of American foreign policy. So I think that it's easier now in this free flow of information to make both material and symbolic connections between the American and Israeli governments at not only the level of policy, but at the practical level of on-the-ground policing and suppression of dissent and these sorts of things.
I think that, too, in addition to that, I think it's interesting to see how the Internet and specifically social networking sites like Twitter have helped to, in some ways, democratize activism and also create bridges of connection, at least possibilities of connection for persons no matter where they are in the world. I mean, I just wonder, you know, what these tools, you know, how they would have impacted so many of the historical moments in our history. And you're right, I do see a bubbling up of younger people who are reaching out on their own, using hashtags and the like to connect with people who are working on the same issue and learning more. I mean, that's the reason why we know names like TEFPO, right? We know his name because in Ferguson, this is one of the activists on the front lines in Ferguson, because Twitter helped to create a platform for his voice to become amplified, not just his voice, but those others who are working alongside him as well. And I think about as well, there was a girl, a Palestinian girl, 16 years old, who was tweeting every night as bombs fell from Israeli planes and shells were shot from tanks. And she was doing on the ground kind of coverage of what it was like living underneath this military assault that was going on. And her voice was amplified by this tool as well. And so I'm excited about that. And I think what I'm most excited about, Mark, is that space is being created for in-depth dialogue. And so right now, where it may be more surface similarities that are being held up, I think eventually that matures. I think that goes deeper at some point into, okay, let's study more of the distinctions between this. Yes, there's a tear gas canister here that was fired in Ferguson and somebody took a picture of it and put it online and traced it back to Jamestown. I think it's Jamestown, in Pennsylvania, this factory in Pennsylvania that has the Israeli flag, you know, waving in front of it. Right. And so the beginning of connecting of dots is happening. And while some of it may be off base and some of it may be too simplistic, my hope is that it will mature, just as the voices of Huey P. Newton and Malcolm X and the rest at one time they were marginalized voices on this issue, and I do see a more mainstreaming of at least this part of the argument, right? And so I think that does happen eventually. But even as I'll say again, honoring as well the distinctions there and also giving voice to just the complexities, man. We're just so used to simple narratives of here's the heroes and here's the villain and let's just go fight. Right. But when people say, well, you know, we got to stand against the Jews or you make comments toward that end, it's problematic because while the state of Israel would love to conflate Judaism and Israel, you know, I know because of my action on the ground and my involvement in communities that you cannot conflate that. You cannot just say, you know, every Jew supports every action that Israel is doing. You can't say that. That community is just as dynamic as any other community, right? And so how do we make room for that dialogue as well? How do we honor that? And then how do we create space for people to wrestle with the complexities and the contradictions in their own identity? Because, yes, I am in the lineage, and I hold it up, I'm in the lineage of Malcolm X and Huey P. Newton. But I'm also in the lineage of people who have said, we stand with Israel. That's a part of our, that's a voice in my community. Unity, right? And that's not an easy, it's not an easy place to be to try to find or try to reconcile that, but it is what it is, right? And so how do we wade through even that complexity and keep our voice at the same time?
This, because this is a very textured, layered question. I mean, there's no, and the textured thing is not about saying that racism and brutality in black communities, that's not textured, it's real. That's happening, and we have to fight to end it. It's not textual when you're saying that Palestinians should have the right to their own nation and not be a colonized people. There's no texture to that. It's just an is, and most people are saying, enough, enough. It has to end. I think all that's true. What you just said is where the texture lives, because the questions of whether it is an anti-Arab sentiment in our world, in the white and black communities and Jewish communities, or whether it is the anti-Semitic sense in part in the black community and other parts of America as well, or the racism inside the Jewish community, all those are part of this very complex situation. And conflating get the Jews with stopping Israel from occupying Palestine, those become, that's where the texture begins, you know, and I think that that's why these are very difficult questions, especially in America, with our kind of heterogeneous world of trying to figure out how to build a movement that addresses that and supports Palestinian liberation and liberation of black folks in America at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think, too, just being careful about language. And so one of the things that, for instance, just an example that I'll do is I'll say, you know, whether I'm writing or protesting or whatever, I'm saying, well, I'm standing against the Israeli government, and the Israeli military and their actions in the occupied West Bank, or their actions in. And so that, you know, it may seem very simplistic to some ears, but that is my way of tipping the hat to the complexity, you know. And then also it has opened the door for conversation as well for people who perhaps are still pledging allegiance to the conflation of, you know, Jews and Israel just being one, right? And so as we are careful about language, I think it also can help serve as an instructive tool so that we might just continue to mature in the way that we understand and engage the issue.
Stephen, you want to comment on that before we wind out?
Oh, I just would say to Reverend Hebert, that's the, you know, beautifully stated, quick thought that in the end, you know, we're all aware of the fact that, you know, people, a lot of young people are getting brutalized and in some cases slaughtered by state violence. And so it is important that we put our heads together and have serious, frank conversations. And then, like the Reverend said, it's not going to be easy, but nor should it be. These issues aren't easy. Human beings aren't easy. We're complex, and we need to have complex discussions. But I think in the end, we need to make sure that we're working for a common goal. And in my mind, that common goal is the ending of systematic state violence against groups that don't have the same set of rights as majorities, whether it's in Palestine or here in the United States.
And can I say just real quick on the end of that, too? Even as we tip the hat and we acknowledge the complexity of the issue, I also want to say that recognizing the complexity of the occupation of Palestinians, or recognizing the complexity involved in anti-Semitic thought in Jewish communities or state violence against black bodies in the United States, the complexity alone should not serve as an excuse to inaction, right? I think that there can be times when, you know, we round table and town hall ourselves to death And that we just keep on talking about it, because at some point we got to make a decision, and those decisions will come with some degree of sacrifice or risk, no matter what it is. Right. So once you acknowledge the complexity, I think you got to make some steps. And so whether that's college students on a campus, whether that's a preacher in the pulpit, whether that's a Palestinian talking to his or her parents about the corner store they own in the black community, there is some risk involved. And as the professor said, you know, this is, it should, it's necessarily difficult. But we have to be the ones who at least build another room on the house of this issue, so that those who are coming behind us will take the ball. And one day they say, you know what, that Heber Brown was wrong as two left shoes, but he fell forward. You know what I mean? I'd rather be accused of falling forward than sitting silent.
The Reverend Heber Brown has been with us once again. He's pastor of the Pleasant Hope Baptist Church, a community activist and executive director of Orisha's Cross Freedom School. And we're joined by Dr. Stephen Salata, an activist, independent academic, author of many books, including Israel's Dead Soul, his latest. And I call him an independent academic because of the assault on academic freedom, he was denied his position as a tenured professor at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign in Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, because of his stance about Israel and things he tweeted and said, which caused a huge stir. And so rather than being tenured, he's independent. So you throw that out there as well. So we hope that he does get tenured at some point soon, someplace. But this coming Friday, Heber Brown and Stephen Salata will be speaking at CCBC Essex at 12:30 p.m. The panel is called From Palestine to Ferguson, What Are the Connections? And it's sponsored by CCBC's Institute for Social and Economic Justice, Black Student Union, Department of World Languages, and the Community Book Connection and CCBC's Global Education. Then at 4:30, Stephen Salata will be speaking at the Homewood campus of Johns Hopkins University as part of their day-long teach-in for Gaza on a panel called Boycott as Resistance and Academic Freedom. And Dr. Stephen Salata and the Reverend Dr. Heber Brown, thank you both so much for being with us here on the Mark Steiner Show.
Thanks, Mark.
It was an honor. Thank you.